Thank you, Professor Chamberlain, and thank you. I want to acknowledge the tort law research group here, and of which Professor Chamberlain's also a part. In particular, I want to acknowledge Professor Nyers. Many of you who have him as a professor may not recognize it, but he is a leading scholar in our field, and he, frankly, is the gold standard for collegiality. And he's been a help to me for a very long time. And so I just want to acknowledge Jason in particular, and also thank Cohen Hiley, LLP, for their sponsorship of this. So causation. Well, now those of you in first year should just be quivering with anticipation. This is just a fantastic subject, and it's really easy. No, it's not. It's brutal. But just to make you feel better, the Supreme Court hasn't gotten it either. but I'll leave that for your your tort professors to explain why. I was looking over a year ago my evaluations that, you know, you get to write these evaluations, I'm sure, about, you know, why Chamberlain or why Nyers are really good, and presumably, and someone wrote on the back of mine, this course should be called Everything the Supreme Court Touches, They Turn to Crap. Which I think was meant as a criticism. And probably only the professors in the room would really realize how fervently I hope that they go on to take trust with Professor McInnes, so that if they think I'm tough on the Supreme Court, wait till they hear this guy. Anyways, thank you for the invitation to speak on cause and fact. It's a subject that I've been thinking about for the last, I guess, 5 years or so, and most of my focus, certainly my focus for the last couple of years, has been directed towards cases of factual uncertainty where there are multiple potential causative factors. And this is most often a case, most often the instance in cases of medical negligence, which are incredibly difficult kinds of cases to succeed on now. Medical negligence is almost a dead industry in British Columbia and in Alberta. And one of the reasons for this, I think the principal reason, is the evolving case law on cause and fact. Now, of course, the burden of proving cause and fact, and cause and fact, for those of you who haven't experienced this in tort law yet, cause and fact is simply the requirement that the plaintiff show that the defendant's negligence actually caused the harm, right? That there is a causal linkage between the defendant's risk-creating activity and the resulting damage to the plaintiff. And obviously, the plaintiff has always had to show that. But it seems to me that the burden is now effectively greater in medical negligence cases, in particular because we as a society, through our scientific expert community, have learned more about the nuanced quality of our physiology and of how our bodies interact with internal and external phenomena. And the more that our scientific expert community has been able to show that determining the causes of effects is actually a much more complex undertaking than we might have understood not all that long ago, the harder it is for the plaintiff to prove causation, right? The harder it is for the plaintiff to show that the defendant actually caused this. So if an injury to a plaintiff is preceded by what appears at first glance to be its cause, 30 years ago, we might well have said that that apparently causative event is in fact the cause, merely on the basis that it was followed shortly thereafter by the injury. Whereas now, the waters are more likely to be muddied by defense experts who will point to other potentially causative factors. Factors that, while scientifically known, in that we know they exist, are etiologically unknown. We don't know how they play out. Right, so the plaintiff has pre-existing conditions. There's a reason why they were going to see the physician after all. And those might have caused this problem too, but we just don't know whether they would have or not. And in that circumstance, it's obviously harder for the party with the burden of proof, right? The party that lives or dies on the evidence. Now, how have plaintiffs tried to deal with this? Well, they have, in recent years, urged adoption of a new test for causation, right? The usual test for causation, and the Supreme Court affirms this again and again, is the but-for test. If this would not have happened but for the defendant's negligence, then that's it, right? The defendant's liable. And so you, if we create a counterfactual, if we remove the defendant's negligence from the narrative, what would happen? If the plaintiff still would have suffered the harm, then the defendant can't be liable, right? But if the harm would not have occurred if we remove the defendant's negligence from the equation, then the defendant is liable. Plaintiffs have urged adoption of a different test, a test called the material contribution test, which has several iterations. And the most recent iteration is a case called Resurface and Hanke, which I won't bore you with, but what that does is it relaxes the requirement. It doesn't actually require the plaintiff to prove that the defendant contributed to the actual harm. It merely shows that the defendant, it merely requires that the plaintiff show that the defendant contributed to the risk of harm. Now, plaintiffs typically aren't succeeding in invoking that test. Courts of appeal are not allowing them to do it. Given that, what is the answer for the plaintiff? Is it simply that the plaintiff lose in cases of factual uncertainty, or is it possible in some cases, even just and appropriate, to find for the plaintiff, even if it means that the fact finder, right, the judge or jury sometimes, has to go where the scientist fears to tread, where the scientist won't go? And I've given quite a bit of thought lately to just that. And I have developed this idea that the solution to this problem posed by factual or scientific uncertainty lies in really taking seriously what the Supreme Court said in a case called Snell and Farrell about 20 years ago, and thinking rigorously about what it said, which was that in cases of scientific uncertainty, it is still open to a fact finder to infer a causal relationship between the defendant's risk-creating behavior and the harm to the plaintiff. And this case in Snell has been reaffirmed on every possible occasion by the Supreme Court. And the facts of it may be known to some of you, but just in case, I'm going to review it for everyone. The plaintiff, who was in her 70s, by the time of trial anyways, undergoes surgery to remove a cataract. And in the course of the surgery, she exhibits what's called a retrobulbar hemorrhage, bleeding behind her eyeball, which is a normal and non-negligent risk. Right? At this point, the surgeon has not been negligent. What is negligent is the surgeon continues with the cataract surgery. What is accepted he should have done was abort the surgery, down tools, treat the bleeding. Because the retrobulbar bleeding creates a risk of her optic nerve atrophying, of the blood damaging the cells on the optic nerve, leading to optic nerve atrophy and leading to blindness. Several months later, when her bandages are removed, her optic nerve, golly gee, is observed to have atrophied to the point of blindness. Now, the atrophy had several possible causes. It could have been the surgeon's negligent failure to treat the bleeding, or it could have been any of three separate conditions, glaucoma, diabetes, and high blood pressure, which she had, although in a controlled form at the time. So she sues the physician. She retains her expert. The physician retains his expert. Both experts say that the cause of the atrophied optic nerve is uncertain. The question to consider then was whether, in the face of that factual uncertainty, that is, in the absence of a scientific verification of a causal link between the defendant's negligent failure to treat the bleeding and her blindness, it was open to the fact finder to infer that such a link existed in any event. And Justice Sapinka for the Supreme Court said it was. Why? Well, he relied on a famous invocation by one of the members of the House of Lords named Lord Salmon in a case called Alpha Cell. He later repeated it in a case called McGee, of common sense. He says it's common sense. Causation is a practical question of fact, best answered by a robust and pragmatic approach to the evidence and the application of ordinary common sense. So Justice Sapinka cites that, and that point made, he then returns to the trial evidence in Snell. Remember, the experts were uncertain. They couldn't tell what had happened. But he points out that the trial judge had admitted that he was inclined to the view that the cause of the blindness was not natural. Right? That the cause of the blindness was, in fact, the surgeon's negligence. Justice Sapinka interprets that as meaning that the trial judge had drawn, as a matter of ordinary common sense, an inference, a causal inference. So that's Snell. Now let me give you another example, discuss another case with you that involves factual uncertainty. And this was the leading case in England on the subject until 2003, when the House of Lords decided you couldn't do this anymore. And it's a case upon which Justice Sapinka leaned heavily in his decision in Snell. And it's a case called Wilshire, Wilshire and Essex Health Authority. Now in Wilshire, the plaintiff was an extremely unfortunate child. He was prematurely born, and he was negligently over-treated, or over-oxidized, 2 or 3 hours after he was born. And he subsequently developed a condition called retrolental fibroplasia, RLF. One possible cause of which was the over-oxidization. But he also suffered from as many as 5 other conditions, any one of which, on their own, could have caused the RLF. And the expert witnesses were in disagreement about whether the over-oxidization had anything to do with this at all. And one of the judges in that case, Lord Bridge, in what is generally recognized, I think, as the lead judgment, defended the notion of causal inference. He says the evidence of increased risk created by the defendant can be treated in a common sense fashion. So at least as a general proposition, courts may make causal inferences in the absence of scientific verification connecting harm to risk. But when he then turned to consider whether that very kind of inference could be drawn in Wilshire, he said, no, it can't. Right? The evidence of increased risk here, he says, provides no evidence and raises no presumption that it was the over-oxidization and not one of the other conditions that this poor child had which caused or contributed to the RLF. In short, while the drawing of a causal inference by employing common sense is legitimate in general, it couldn't be done here. So for the House of Lords at that time anyways, as well as for the Supreme Court of Canada, it is open to a fact finder to infer a causal relationship between risk and harm from the circumstances of the case. And whether an inference is to be drawn, as in Snell, or is not to be drawn, as in Wilshire, in the face of uncertain evidence, in the face of conflicting evidence, is a matter of weighing the evidence in a robust and pragmatic fashion and using ordinary common sense. So there's some authority from the House of Lords as well as for the Supreme Court of Canada that factual uncertainty need not be the end of the inquiry. Evidence can be weighed, albeit in a robust and pragmatic fashion, whatever that means. More about that shortly. Since causation is not a matter of scientific certainty, it is a matter of common sense, whatever that means. Now, I want to show that the essential insight of Snell is correct, meaning this idea that where scientific expert evidence is unable to verify a causal relationship between the defendant's creation of risk and the plaintiff's loss, a fact finder may go where the scientist fails to go. Or fears to go, that the legal fact finder may infer a link, but with a caveat, which I'll elaborate on towards the end of my talk today, because it brings me to my current work that I'm just sort of putting out there, to the extent that I have current work that the joys of faculty administration allow for, on causation, being that I reject as bump these vacuous references to an approach that is robust and pragmatic, or to questions of fact that are practical, or to common sense that is ordinary. It is meaningless cant, and it is derived, I think, in part from, in some cases, with respect to some members of the bench, an anti-intellectual laziness, or perhaps more charitably, and I think this is the case in many cases, an insecurity on the part of judges who feel that it is an impossible exercise to justify a finding of fact which is not objectively demonstrable, right? One way or the other. Now, even if we put aside those terms, and I will come back to this, there remain substantial criticisms of causal inference in cases of factual uncertainty. And in my work, I've gone through some of them, and I think they can be generalized or categorized into two general concerns. The first is that scientific evidence is inherently reliable, or at least it's more reliable than an inference drawn by some judge without the benefit of verifying scientific evidence. And I'm going to elaborate upon this shortly, but my answer in a nutshell is that fact-finding, scientific fact-finding, while maybe of potential assistance to legal fact-finders, cannot be determinative of legal outcomes because it fails to account for the cognitive processes that legal fact-finders have to, that they necessarily bring to bear upon the evidence. And those processes make causal inference an unavoidable characteristic, right, of any causal inquiry, because we can never know with certainty whether a particular mechanism that could link risk to harm actually occurred in a given case. So legal fact finders are always left with having to infer whether there was a causal link or not. So that's the first criticism that I see being directed against the idea of causal inference, both by judges and by legal commentators. Secondly, the second criticism is that no legal fact finder, right, no judge, can legitimately infer cause in fact in the absence of scientific evidence. Not only is scientific evidence better, you can't go where the scientist fears to tread. If a scientist doesn't know whether there's causation, how on earth can a judge say that there is causation? And here again, I'm going to suggest that the imminence, that is the unavoidability of inferential reasoning within legal fact-finding, within the cognitive process that the judge goes through, answers this criticism. So this is where my current research is focused, trying, albeit tentatively, to delve into the adjudicative context in which causation determinations are made. The adjudicative context with its uncertain threshold of proof, right? Do you know yet, first years, what the standard of proof is for civil cases or balance of probabilities? Excellent, I can read lips. And I heard what you said about Nyers. Right, that context, right, contemplates drawing conclusions that fall short of thresholds of certainty. And it suggests to me that a justification for causal inference might not be found necessarily in sort of understandings or theories or whatever you want to call them of causation, but rather in an understanding or theory of judging, and specifically of judging evidence. And this builds on some of my past work, which introduced evidence law scholarship, I see Peter here, to the debate within tort law about causal inference as a way of bringing an air of sort of adjudicative reality to the academic discourse about causal inference. But it also carries on to my current stuff. So turning then to the first criticism of causal inference, that it disregards a supposed need for scientific evidence, that scientific evidence is more reliable if you want to link the defendant's risk-creating behavior to the plaintiff's suffering. And I've advanced two responses. First, that scientific fact-finding is not the same thing as legal fact-finding. And there may be some of you with undergraduate degrees in science here who can probably give a lot more insight than I can on this, so I won't spend a lot of time on this, except to say that if that is so, then to precondition legal fact-finding upon scientific fact-finding is literally unjust, right? It's unjust in a very legal sense. And I won't belabor this point, as I say, some of you probably understand more about it than I do, but also because when you get to reading Snell and Farrell, you will see that Justice Sapinka actually alludes to this point. The problem, he says, and I actually think this is only part of the problem, but the problem, he says, is the differing burdens of proof, the differing thresholds of proof employed by science as opposed to law, whereby statistically significant conclusions in science occur at a much higher confidence interval than the balance of probabilities. It's not enough for a scientist to say that it probably happened this way for them to conclude that it happened this way. They have a much higher confidence interval that has to be reached before they'll draw that conclusion. I actually think that's only part of the issue. I think the more fundamental difference is something Snell doesn't explore, which is the distinct fact-finding methodologies that underlie science and law. Inasmuch as scientists, unlike trial judges, may, through repeated experimentation and replication of this event over and over again, refine their understanding of the causal links by eliminating anomalies until that necessary, there's a fly buzzing around here, statistical threshold is reached. But such prudence is obviously not open to a trial judge, right? You are not going to stand in the superior court and say, "My lady, we thought we would run this car accident by you a few times, and just let's see what happens to the plaintiff's lumbar region." Right? That's not going to happen, right? The trial judge's job is not to watch replications of events. The trial judge's job is to reach a decision. So I think Snell is right, because scientific fact-finding occurs at a higher threshold of certainty, and scientific fact-finding isn't the same thing as legal fact-finding. Now, even if we account for those differences, for scientific fact-finding to adequately substitute for legal fact-finding, it also has to do something else. It has to account within a deductive structure for things like credibility, for the cognitive processes that a judge will apply when they see an expert bite his nails or wink at opposing counsel or just present themselves in a way that they think impacts positively or negatively upon their credibility. Now, that's impossible. It's impossible to reduce that statistically, because the cognitive routes by which these kinds of variables are processed defy any sort of statistical reduction. The most that we can say is such evidence may or may not affect the outcome. It depends on the fact finder's experience, which will include the submissions and that the counsel make and other observations that they make during the trial. So there are these divergent thresholds, and there are these divergent, if you like, epistemologies, which mean that scientific fact-finding isn't the same thing as legal fact-finding, and so the latter shouldn't depend upon the former. So that's my first point in response to this objection that scientific fact-finding is more reliable. The second, and this is an old objection, but I still think it's a valid one, is that scientific fact-finding has a statistical methodology that only speaks to whether causation can exist in this kind of situation. It speaks, in other words, to causal generalizations. It doesn't tell us whether cause, in fact, existed in the particular case before us. So when an expert gives evidence at trial, all they are usually able to say is that based on some statistical data, which usually the expert himself or herself did not collect, right, they're just reading this in the literature, they'll say, based on that, it is statistically probable or improbable that a causal link exists in a given case. Now, that tells us about lots of other cases, but it doesn't tell us about this case. It doesn't tell us whether, and in fact, it doesn't tell us much about the other cases either, when you think about it. It doesn't tell us whether the subjects of those other experiments that generated the data were the same kind of person as the person we're dealing with here. So, for example, take the plaintiff in Snell. How many of them were 70 years old? Right? How many of them had glaucoma? How many of them had high blood pressure? But even allowing for that, the overall objection is that the process risks becoming a trial by mathematics. And the arguments here are obviously sort of far from new. Some people that you may be familiar with through some of your readings, Glanville Williams, Richard Wright, Lara Khoury, and others have all made it, that statistics tell us only about the frequency in which increased risk may translate into suffering. It doesn't tell us anything about whether that actually occurred here. Now, I'm going to do this. There's I thought I might take a quick little diversion here because there is a related issue that I haven't really taken a side on in this, and I'm actually sort of struggled with it. I've been questioned on this now for a couple of years, and it's this. Well, okay, if you can't use statistics for determining whether there was a causal link in this particular case, right? If we can't use statistics for determining the issue of causation, can we use them for any other purpose, like, for example, giving us levels of confidence, you know, boosting our confidence or maybe our trepidation in the causal determination that we might otherwise make? Is it something that can go into the matrix of facts, right? Just throw it in the bag with everything else that the fact finder has to consider? Or is it something that we leave out altogether? And funnily enough, about 48 hours after I was given that question at a conference in the UK, I was beginning my annual summer vacation in Waterton Lakes National Park. I don't know if any of you are here from Alberta, but that's at the southwest corner of Alberta. It borders Montana and British Columbia. And outside of the west coast, northwest coast of North America, it has the highest concentration of grizzly bears in North America. And I was doing my usual safe routine of getting up at 5:30 in the morning and hiking alone into the higher elevation trails of Waterton Lakes National Park. And literally about 48 hours after I've got some people asking me this question, I'm about 30 meters away from a big male grizzly bear. And, you know, obviously it turned out fine, right? He did what he was supposed to do, and I did what I was supposed to do, and we spent about 20 or 30 very exciting seconds in each other's company. Okay, but this is what us geeks do. On the way back down, I'm actually thinking about this in terms of the question that had been posed to me 2 days earlier about risk. And the reason is this, and I realize this is kind of a perspective risk issue instead of a retrospective causal issue, but I'm aware of statistics. I had bear spray with me, okay, and I didn't discharge it, but I had it out of the holster and, you know, sort of do that. And I thought, wow, that was sort of interesting. I had to use my bear spray. And, so I'm aware of statistical evidence compiled by some researchers at the University of Calgary, and those statistics suggest that bear spray, and I assume you all know what bear spray is, it's got an active agent, capsaicin, pepper spray, right? And so the idea is if the bear comes within 4 to 9 meters of you, which seems awfully close, then you use it on the bear and it's supposed to repel the bear. And the researchers say that in fact will usually be the case. In fact, they documented all sorts of publicly known attacks by grizzlies and black bears in the Rocky Mountain corridor from Jasper down to Yellowstone, and they discovered that of all the reported instances, bear spray repelled 100% of black bear attacks and 94% of grizzly bear attacks, and it also repelled 100% of approaches by so-called curious grizzly bears and 73% of approaches of curious black bears. And I don't know anything more about the bears. I don't know, for example, were they high-risk bears? Were they sows protecting cubs? Were they bears that had become accustomed to humans? Did one of them have a dead elk cached over that it was trying to protect? I don't know. And I don't know anything about the humans involved. I don't know if they were carrying, you know, hot dogs in their packs, or whether they were females in menstruation, which is apparently a very bad thing to be if you're in grizzly country. But I don't know, furthermore, in advance, whether I'm one of those lucky 94% of hikers who, if charged, would repel the grizzly, or if I'm one of the 6%, you know, who will be identified by bits of clothing in the grizzly's stomach after the necropsy. I mean, I just don't know. And yet, I carry bear spray. And I don't know, and I'm not taking it as determinative of the outcome. If I did, I wouldn't engage in other safe practices like keeping my food to dry goods, or making noise every minute, or hiking at better times, which I now do. The point is that I'm not using, my reliance on bear spray does not lead me to the determination that I'm not going to be mauled. But it gives the statistics of its effect, about its effectiveness, give me a confidence level. Right? That you know, if I'm smart and all these do these other precautions, I probably won't be mauled. Now, as I say, that's a prospective risk issue. It's not a retrospective causation problem. And I haven't decided yet where I fall on this. But I thought I would put it out there and see if any of you have comments on this later. Now, before moving on to how I think we can and should treat causal inferences, I want to reach back to a point I made a moment ago, because it's key to everything that follows, that these soft variables about a witness's smirk or an expert winking at counsel or something like that defy easy statistical reduction. I think it's worth considering whether that point is not more broadly applicable. That is, not just to smirks or sideways glances, but to evidence more generally. All kinds of evidence, viva voce evidence that witnesses say in trial, documentary evidence, physical evidence. Because I think the problem with denying the judge's entitlement to infer cause and fact from evidence of increased risk is that evidence never sort of speaks for itself. It doesn't state its own implications. Right? It doesn't manifest in some explicit way its probative quality. Rather, evidence acquires significance by the inferential value that we ascribe to it. Right? Until we ascribe some inferential value to evidence, it's just information that awaits some interpretation and whose probative value will depend upon the strength that it lends to a particular inference at trial. And this is a fundamental point. I think that particularizing cause and fact, that is in saying that we are determining whether cause and fact happened on this particular occasion, always requires us to draw inferences. Right? Inference is an unavoidable means of causal determination. And so fact finders always find facts by choosing whether or not to infer. If I see my 7-year-old crying, and I see my 9-year-old standing over him and holding a stick and looking scared when he sees me, right? Now those facts don't speak for themselves. I might infer that my 9-year-old just whacked the 7-year-old with the stick, or knowing the characters and having drawn my own observations, I may conclude that in fact what happened was the 7-year-old was trying to hit the 9-year-old with the stick, the 9-year-old grabs the stick, the 7-year-old cries, the 9-year-old looks at me, thinks I'm drawing the first inference, right, and is concerned. Right? The point is that Snell's insight, I think, is of universal application. You can't exclude inference drawing from causal fact-finding because it is implicit in all legal fact-finding. It is the process by which we ascribe or do not ascribe significance to information. And it is what is candidly astonishing to me is how Canadian courts have missed this point. And so there's a case called Kozak and Funk out of the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal, a good court, a strong court, I think, on most tort questions. But this statement is being cited by commentators and trial courts all over the place, and I think it's incredibly damaging. Court says this: Snell, so that's the case with the blind lady, Snell does not stand for the proposition that an inference may be drawn in the absence of evidence. So Snell doesn't say that you draw inferences absent evidence, or that the court is entitled to bridge, by way of an inference, a gap in the evidence. So the court says two things. You can't infer in the absence of evidence, and you can't use an inference to bridge a gap in the evidence. Now, while it is true that Snell does not stand for the proposition that an inference may be drawn in the absence of evidence, that is, with great respect, beside the point. Inferences are never drawn in the absence of evidence. They are, by definition, drawn from evidence. But, and this comes to the second point, stitching together the evidence into an account of what happened will always involve bridging gaps. Right? Because there is no demonstrable instance of causal linkage between risk and harm, ever. in any given case. Or from one fact to the next, and that A happened and then A led to B. It's that led to part between A and B that is typically unknowable. All we know for certain is that A preceded B. And so there are always gaps in every case that fact finders may or may not choose to bridge by the drawing of an inference. So to insist upon evidence that shows some causal glue linking A and B together is to insist upon something that cannot be shown. There is never evidence of cause and fact in the sense of objectively demonstrable causal glue. Instead, fact finders have to find it. That's why we call them fact finders. It's not made plain and obvious on the table for them. They have to make a judgment call. So if we take Snell seriously, and we see that causal inference can be drawn from any evidence, including mere evidence of risk, combined, as was in the case in Snell, with sort of a temporal coincidence between risk or harm, we see that it actually is possible in most cases for the court to infer, or at least to consider, whether it should infer drawing a causal link. Now, obviously, they won't always want to do it. And obviously, and this is a more important point, that risks an objectively incorrect causal determination. But that's a risk that fact finders run in every case. Remember, the threshold for fact finding is not certainty. The threshold for fact finding is probability. That is, as Lord Brown at the Supreme Court of the UK just said in a case called Sinkowitz, part of the rough justice about the law of personal injury liability as a whole. Right? That risk is inherent in these cases. But we have to take that risk seriously. Right? It's for that very reason that causal inferences may be incorrect or may be drawn incorrectly, that we need to examine how judges justify their conclusions for drawing a link between putative cause and effect. And you know, how do they justify what is not demonstrable? And more fundamentally, do they have to do that? And I think it's useful to consider why we refer disputes to judges. I mean, we could, and in Ontario it's done fairly frequently. Where I first practiced law in British Columbia, it's done all the time. We could refer them to civil juries. Right? Civil juries are commonly used in British Columbia. I did a few jury trials and actually kind of liked them. There seems no obvious basis why we would prefer a judge over a juror as a fact finder. Right? You don't take courses in fact finding here, I assume. You don't take courses in, you know, inferring causation 435. Right? You study law. And yet the vast majority of fact finders, and by the way, I should say, I learned to be a fact finder by being a parent, right? Because you get, think about this, right? You get multiple inconsistent, totally self-serving, right? Dubiously reliable accounts of a dispute, right? And with very little room for settlement. And your job is to cobble together an account that makes sense, and upon which rights will be, you know, vindicated or taken away. So there's no reason, right, to suppose that judges would be sort of better fact finders than jurors, and yet we prefer judges as fact finders in most cases. And I think that one of the reasons, I think there's a number of reasons, but I think that one of the most important reasons for preferring judges, or that people prefer judges over jurors, it lies in the most jarring distinction between the two, which is judges have to give reasons and jurors don't. Jurors just reach a result. Right? Judges not only have the power to find facts, but they have the obligation to explain why the facts that they've found. And I think that is an implication of the legitimacy of judicial authority in a couple of senses. Right? First, as I've said, judges have to give reasons. But secondly, that the content of those reasons matters. Otherwise, why require them to give reasons? So in the time I have left, I'd like to just briefly consider both of those implications, and this goes to my current work. As to the obligation to give reasons, I adopt a standpoint that Professor Nyers has actually adopted in some of his work, that of public justification. Right? The idea being that when courts pronounce obligations, that obligation has to be justified in a way that is public, in the sense that a reasonable member of the public might appreciate, even if they don't agree with the outcome, with the specific outcome, they appreciate the fact finder's underlying reasoning as cogent and as impartial. And you'll see this standpoint expressed in legal scholarship. It's deeply infused with the philosophy of an American named John Rawls, that some of you may have encountered, who conceived of state coercion as legitimate in democracies only where it could be agreed to by all citizens as citizens, right? And which in turn required that the coercion be justified by public reasons, being those reasons that seem politically reasonable to when addressed to citizens as citizens. Now, Rawls was obviously speaking to the political order as distinct from a juristic order, but scholars such as Peter Benson at Toronto, and I might add Professor Nyers, have shown that the idea of public justification in the political sphere may be applicable to private legal relations. Right? And the idea is that states claim sovereignty over the individual, not just through the executive and legislative branches, but through the judicial branch as well. And in fact, Rawls himself acknowledged this breadth to his argument. And in fact, when you think about it, the idea that judge-made law, even in the mundane context of a sort of a personal injury claim, a tort law claim, like any other activity of the state, requires justification, is fundamental to tort law, right? Because tort law, if I can sort of sound like the libertarian Albertan for a second here, tort law presumes liberty of action, right? Tort law only confines you, but it presumes that without that confinement, you can do what you want. Now, the point isn't that state interference is prohibited, but that coercion always needs a special justification, right? And that burden of justification rests upon the state that seeks to coerce the defendant by compensating the plaintiff. So if judicial interference with that prior autonomy achieved via, in part, a causal finding, right? Because that's what it is, a judicial interference, telling you to pay money to the plaintiff. If that's to be justified, then that justification, like the constitutional order that underlies it, ought to be public. That's the idea of public justification as applied, at least, to a causal finding. And the idea is we need some way of denoting the findings of law and fact that reasonable citizens accept as cogent and impartial. And I emphasize findings of law and fact, because causation is a finding of fact. And my fundamental point here is that public reason, as a judicial imperative, arises in both the fact-finding as well as the law-finding aspects of adjudication, because it is, after all, in the found facts that we find the trigger, right, for the legal obligation. At least in part. So the reasons underlying the facts that we find, the facts that lead us to requiring the defendant to restore the plaintiff in some way, ought to be reasonable. Reasons that people can not only understand, but reasons that they also accept as cogent and impartial. So from all this, I suggest that bald references to common sense, right, and to practical questions of fact. But let's stick with common sense. With no attempt to actually explain the reasoning that underlies a finding of cause in fact or a refusal, right, to find cause in fact, do not meet the requirement that a judge's reasons be publicly justified. Common sense is simply, as a reason for anything, let alone for a finding of causation, meaningless. As such, it requires explication. And this goes to the second point that arises from the judicial capacity to give reasons. Not only that they should give reasons, but that the content of those reasons matters. Now, I think the difficulty for judges is this impossibility, and it's really a superficial impossibility, of justifying that which cannot be objectively verified. How can I say there was causation here if the scientist won't tell me? But I don't think that should pose such a high hurdle. Right? Remember that justification of a finding of cause in fact does not require certain truth. Right? The standard here is a balance of probabilities. And so to insist upon a justification for causal inferences does not require the impossible. It is possible and can be done. So thinking for a minute about Snell and Wilshire. So Snell was the 70-year-old lady with the three pre-existing conditions, and Wilshire was that prematurely born infant who had five pre-existing conditions. We're not told. We're just told without anything further that it is possible to draw common sense inferences of causation, and that it was possible in Snell, but it wasn't possible in Wilshire. But there's really no attempt to justify those specific outcomes in the case with reference to anything besides common sense. But I think it is possible, so long, remember, this is the important point, that we accept that a search for a certain explanation is never in the cards. Right? We can construct publicly reasonable, that is, cogent explanations for these contrasting outcomes that people would accept as reasoned, even if they don't like the specific outcome. So, for example, while we are not told for how long Mrs. Snell had been suffering from those pre-existing conditions that she had, it's a fair bet, isn't it, that she had been suffering, given that she was 70 years old, it's a fair bet that she'd been suffering from them for longer than the 2 or 3 hours of life that preceded the negligent treatment of the child in Wilshire. Right? And we know they were controlled, so it is quite possible that a fact finder said, okay, she's got these pre-existing conditions, and then there's this moment in time where the physician is negligent in just the way that could have created this risk. And then in just enough time for the blood to kill off the cells and atrophy her optic nerve, guess what happens? Her optic nerve's atrophy. I wonder if it had anything to do with the surgeon's negligence. I think it probably was, given that the other conditions were asymptomatic at the time. It's cogent. Right? Conversely, in Wilshire, you know, it was just too dicey. Maybe that was the problem. This child had been alive for 2 to 3 hours. We have no idea how these five pre-existing conditions would have played out. There just wasn't the life history that allows us to draw a causal inference. And given that the plaintiff bears the burden of proof, the plaintiff unfortunately wears this. Now, I'm not saying that that reasoning was what in fact prompted these outcomes. I don't know. But just to explain, rather, that the outcomes need not have been, or the explanation for these outcomes need not have been confined to a bald reference to common sense. Right? And common sense, while it may be a shorthand term for a method of finding cause and fact, which is actually, I think, what Lord Salmon intended when he used that, it's no reason for finding cause and fact. Accordingly, when common sense is offered as a reason, as it was in Snell, we have no reason. We have a vacuous judicial statement. We have a fudge. Right? So, if reasoning matters, then the content of the reasoning also matters. There has to be something about those reasons, something about their content that makes them legally significant. And I'm currently developing the idea that that unique quality is inherent in the judicial role. It's a judgment call. Judges judge. They employ judgment. And because common sense doesn't express a judgment, then what Snell and Wilshire both lack is an expression of judgment. And I think that what's happened is our judges have confused intuition with judgment. Right? They don't want to make a decision based on intuition, but they don't understand that really what judgment it is taking that intuitive insight and applying argument to it, right? Pro and con. And it's that exercise of an argumentative dimension to judgment, that weighing back and forth of the different arguments and applying them to the competing accounts and to the bits of evidence that I really see as falling within those characteristic judicial virtues that an academic in England, H.L.A. Hart, once described, that judges employ or ought to employ when they have discretion. I think that applies to fact-finding as well as to law-finding. So, to state that common sense is a causal, as a causal explanation lacks an expression of judgment doesn't only mean that it lacks some qualitative assessment. It means that the causal determination itself lacks in authority. It amounts to a naked exercise of power rather than an expression of justice. Now, if I'm right about this, then those of us here who train legal academics should also consider the ramifications for how we train the succeeding generation of lawyers and judges. While we obviously cannot teach students to find facts, that only comes with the contingencies of life, and in my case, having children. We can, and again, if I'm right, we should teach the expression of how facts are found. We should look at trial judgments. We should incorporate into our curriculum an examination of an appreciation for the expression of judgment, and by which we draw students' attention not only to how hard cases involving questions of law are determined, but how the underlying findings of fact are expressed. From the law teacher standpoint, this would require us, I think, to broaden our focus in discussing cases like Snell, perhaps by giving greater emphasis to the lower court decisions, as I mentioned, and identifying the significant and teachable examples of good and bad expression of fact-finding. Even more generally, I think a curriculum that includes an examination of judgment brings home to students, all of you, that your job as a future counsel, or for that matter as a judge, is to be, in some respect, a rhetor, that is, a rhetorician, and that the skill is critical to furnishing the public with the reason for outcomes, and that affirms the legitimacy of judicial authority and the judicial authority specifically to find facts. I think it also would add a new substantive dimension to that commonplace and I think correct understanding of law school as a place to learn critical thinking. By applying such critical thought not only to the reasons that judges give for the law that they find, but to the reasons they give for the facts that they find. Thank you for your attention.